Hey there, I'm Dominic Armato, and this is Skillet Dude's Top Chef Power Rankings for Season 4, Episode 11. Well, that was depressing. Nothing like an hour-long episode with an inevitable train wreck at the end. I realize disappointment over Dale's elimination isn't a universal phenomenon, and yeah, he was a jackass who looked even worse in the bonus footage than he did on the show this week, if you can believe it. But he still deserved to be in the finals, and the competition isn't half as interesting without him. We'll get to the full Dale postmortem in a bit, but first, I want to briefly address the conspiracy theorists who were out in force again this week. I know I shouldn't. I know I should just let it go. The fact is, I can't disprove the existence of a conspiracy to fix the results any more than I can disprove the existence of the Chupacabra. And to be fair, I won't completely discount the possibility that you guys are right and my mind remains open to compelling evidence. But let me just say this, and then we'll leave this topic alone for the rest of the season. Given what we know, if you believe the producers are pulling the strings and influencing elimination decisions to help a woman win the finals, you must believe the following. That a woman winning or a number of women reaching the finals would have a significant impact on ratings. That the producers believe the difference in ratings to be so significant that they're willing to risk completely destroying an already successful show if word ever got out that it was fixed. That the producers also feel it is vitally important to the audience's enjoyment to help women get deeper into the show, and yet seem completely unconcerned with keeping favorites such as Leanne, Sam, Trey, and arguably Dale when there were perfectly viable alternatives. That the show's staff is so incompetent, they can't achieve the same ends simply and with no risk to the show's credibility through careful casting. That female chefs just aren't good enough to compete with male chefs on their own merits and need the help. That the judges are all in on the fix, and regular judges Tom and Ted, having stated in no uncertain terms that the producers have never influenced their decisions, are bald-faced liars. That numerous titans of the food world who were present as guest judges for close calls when men were eliminated, including Paul Kahan, Art Smith, Rick Bayless, and Jose Andres, are in on it as well. That Anthony Bourdain is the kind of guy who's willing to preside over a fixed contest. And that all the people involved, not a single one, has felt compelled to blow the whistle. Now, if all of the above strikes you as reasonable, then yes, it makes perfect sense to believe the Top Chef is fixed. And that's all I have to say about that. Getting back to the good stuff, however, we get another great quickfire here late in the season. I don't think the chefs have been thrown on the line since the inaugural episode when Hubert Keller ruled with an iron fist and gave them the boot at the slightest provocation. Even though the first go-round was a fine dining establishment, I'm betting this was actually the tougher challenge. Eggs are tricky under any circumstances, much less when you're crammed into a tiny station and hammered with orders. Between the show and Leanne's blog, it's unclear whether the winner was strictly a matter of who lasted the longest before getting the boot, or if it was a nebulous judgment call on the part of the owner, but either way, Antonia has executed cleanly under fire all season, so it's not surprising that she was named the winner. Restaurant Wars, on the other hand, felt oddly rushed this year. I think the editors generally do a fine job, but this struck me as an episode that really could have used the extra 15 minutes they tack on from time to time. The pacing of some segments felt off. I have a lot of unanswered questions, and the fact that half the blogging staff is AWOL this week doesn't help matters either. But while most of the attention has been focused on the train wreck that was Team Altamont and the subsequent controversy, let's not overlook the fact that Stephanie, Richard, and Antonia were the first team to absolutely rock Restaurant Wars. We've been saying for weeks that this season's field is unusually strong, and you couldn't ask for stronger evidence than that. Even with Dale out of the picture, assuming these three survive next week, this may turn out to be the best finals yet. There's not much movement this week, which isn't surprising this late in the season, but there is one high-profile jump, and it's a crowd-pleaser. Hanging on to the top spot is Richard, who hasn't wowed us recently, but hey, he's performing well, he has almost a full season of excellence backing him up, and he still looks like the one to beat, as long as he isn't cleaning seafood. Even with Stephanie heating up again and Antonia making a little more noise than usual, I think you have to consider him the favorite, and Dale's ouster only makes him look less vulnerable. All that said, this wasn't the most exciting week for Richard. We don't really have a sense of how he performed in the quickfire, except that he didn't do as well as Dale and Antonia. In the elimination, he held down his position as chef de cuisine admirably, even if his dishes didn't really give us much to go on. I still love the banana scallops, but the operative word here is still. I understand the desire to play it safe, but come on, Richard, show us something new. His beet salad with goat cheese, ras el hanout, honey, and a number of fresh herbs looked rather nice, even given the ubiquity of beet salads these days, and the judges seemed to love it. One thing puzzles me, though. We've seen this beet, goat cheese, and ras el hanout flavor profile before this season. from Ryan in the Zoo Challenge. Now, Richard and Ryan were both members of Team Lion way back when, so was Ryan getting a little help from Richard, or did Richard adopt Ryan's pairing? If it's the latter, I don't think that reflects too poorly on Richard. What we saw this week was a much more refined dish, and by no means the same thing. But it's interesting nonetheless. Incidentally, I think Richard may have also had a hand in the lamb squared, but we'll get to that in a moment. This week, I saw exactly what I needed from Stephanie to put her back above Antonia, so she scoots up to number two. She took control and, by all accounts, was the central figure in shaping the restaurant's character. And while the pressure of opening a restaurant overnight isn't exactly the same kind of pressure as producing a spur-of-the-moment dish in 30 minutes, she handled it beautifully and seemed completely in control throughout. But most importantly, she developed two dishes that were both unconventional and excellent. Now, I'm something of a pasta purist, or at least highly skeptical of newfangled noodles, so the fact that her linguine and clams with sausage and horseradish creme fraiche intrigues me, that says something. And while I'm less surprised by the gorgonzola cheesecake than some, I'm a huge fan of composed cheese courses, I am intrigued by her inclusion of a sweet potato puree along with the grape syrup and walnut crumble. Without the sweet potato, it's an unconventional, if refined, repackaging of a very conventional flavor profile. The sweet potato, however, is totally out of left field, and I may have to cook this up at some point to see how it works. If Stephanie can produce these kinds of dishes in the finals while keeping her wits about her, she'll be far more compelling than Antonia, and she'll absolutely give Richard a run for his money. Antonia didn't have a half-bad week herself, and she actually showed a little more spark than I've come to expect from her, but I still have some questions about what exactly she accomplished, so I'm leaving her at number three. My question rests with the lamb squared, where the braised lamb shank could not possibly be more boilerplate, braised with carrots, celery, leeks, and garlic. And the instructions for the lamb loin are found, oddly enough, in the recipe for Richard's beet salad. My hunch is that this dish, the interesting parts at least, were actually Richard's, not Antonia's. But even though I've been down on Antonia, if only relative to the other top contenders, I must give credit where credit is due. Her trout with cauliflower didn't exactly reinvent the wheel, but it was a subtly creative dish that looked like it was stunningly executed. The sauce was composed of cauliflower, rapini, raisins, capers, hazelnuts, garlic, butter, and cream, and I loved the decision to plate it on the side, leaving the trout crisp, fresh, and pristine. The refinement has always been there with Antonia, but this kind of pizzazz is what's been lacking with her all season. If she can produce this kind of food going forward, I will happily eat my previous criticisms and commence rooting for her openly. But the fact that it's such a grand exception, even within the context of this single episode, keeps me from exhibiting the proverbial irrational exuberance. It also keeps me from allowing her to hold the second spot against a surging Stephanie. Say what you will about Spike's tendency to play gamesman first and chef second, but hey, he's one elimination away from the finals, and I'm keeping him above Lisa at number four. The dude knows when to stick his nose in, when to run for cover, and how to minimize his failings on the chopping block, even if that bit about having to hang Buddhas was laughably lame. Not only did he remove himself from a volatile situation in the kitchen and put himself in the front where he'd be safe as long as Dale and Lisa didn't dazzle the judges, but even on the food front, he picked a dish that he could easily handle and or delegate while playing interior designer, and it was solid but unconventional enough to buy him another week. No, he hasn't wowed people, but his braised short ribs with pickled cabbage and apple basil Thai salad sounds a lot more compelling to me than Antonia's braised lamb shank with carrot, celery, and leeks. I don't mean to defend him in the general sense. He's a cunning gamesman but a weak chef, and if not for Lisa's total inability to put together a coherent dish, he would have owned the basement since Nikki's departure. But as frustrating as it is, you have to acknowledge that he's demonstrated a lot of talent in this competition, even if it isn't exactly the type of talent the competition is meant to reward. The state of Lisa's Top Chef bid can best be summed up by the nature of the Top Chef audience's reaction when she uncorked this little gem.
I'm immediately thinking when we're sending the Loxa out to the judges, it's probably the first time that I've made a huge mistake in this competition.
Ladies and gentlemen, according to Lisa Fernandez, her very first huge mistake of the season came in episode 11 when she oversmoked her Loxa. Never mind that she's now been on the bottom of 8 straight challenges, and never mind that her last 4 dishes, all squarely in her Asian wheelhouse, bombed. According to Lisa, she's just now screwed up for the very first time. I understand the logic behind Dale's ouster, and I can't fault the judges for making that call, but I also think it was the wrong call. Speaking of which, I said it last week, and I stand by it now. I think Dale's 6th place finish, more than Leanne finishing 4th, more than Sam finishing with a share of 3rd, and even more than Trey finishing 8th, is the single biggest upset elimination in the history of the show. Opinion seems to be split over whether Dale deserved the praise or was highly overrated, but from what I've seen, most people who follow the second school of thought haven't been reading his recipes. His work was crisp, it was imaginative, it was compelling, and while his attitude had significant flaws, his food, for the most part, did not. All that said, however, whether or not you agree with the judge's decision, Dale put his own head on the chopping block. And as disappointed as I was with the decision, as I rewatched the episode, I see more and more places where he simply and inarguably screwed up. No matter how justified his feelings about some of his fellow competitors were, that just wasn't an excuse for a terrible attitude. He was snide, surly, and combative, not just with his teammates, but with the judges as well. And as mentioned above, based on the bonus footage, it looks like the final edit actually cut some of the more objectionable material. He also made a mess of his executive chef role, rolling out a menu that was surprisingly tame and traditional, and still failing to deliver, both through bad planning and bad decisions. Whole Foods doesn't have the sticky rice you need? Okay, stop right there. Choose another dessert. And if you forge ahead anyway and it turns out terribly, suck it up and 86 it. Yeah, it's going to look bad, but at least you're demonstrating that as executive chef, you're exercising some control and pride in what you serve. And contrary to popular belief, not only can the executive chef of the losing team survive, but the executive chef of the losing team has survived half of the time. See Leanne in Season 1 and Sam in Season 2. But to pull it off, you have to take responsibility for the mistakes you made and demonstrate that you understand what you did wrong, neither of which Dale seemed inclined to do. But lastly, and most importantly, you can't make lousy food. We get mixed signals on the dumplings. Padma loves them. Ted appreciates the crust, but Bourdain implies they were greasy. Same thing on the Hollow Hollow. Andres, unfamiliar with the dish, is impressed. Bourdain, familiar with the dish, feels it's competent but familiar. But you know what strikes me? What Dale served for Restaurant Wars after the benefit of experience was actually a dumbed-down version of his Episode 7 Hollow Hollow. That one was praised for bringing together all kinds of disparate flavors and textures into a pleasing, refreshing whole. But in the Restaurant Wars version, half those elements were missing. And lastly, he turned out an entree that the judges absolutely hated. And lest we forget, on Top Chef, bad sweet is more forgivable than bad savory. I'm going to stand up for Dale a little bit here. For starters, despite the dish's title and without going into great detail, what he made wasn't butterscotch. It was caramel with some butter and some scotch whisked in. And while butterscotch in a savory context isn't Vietnamese, caramel in a savory context very much is, and it absolutely can and does work. But in Vietnam, the caramel sweetness is tempered first by the fact that the sugar is cooked just shy of burning, which adds a strong bitter component, and second, by the inclusion, usually I believe Vietnamese experts please jump in here, of fish sauce, the excessively salty and funky properties of which, again, take the edge off the sweetness. Now, while I understand it in theory because of its saltiness, I don't see miso having quite that same effect, and based on the color of the sauce, I'm thinking he didn't take the heated sugar close enough to the brink before shutting it down, thereby making what should have been a bittersweet sauce merely sweet. And while I don't know if it has any traditional roots, I'm also going to question the pairing with scallops. But my point is simply that I think this was an error in execution, not the crazy lack of judgment that it may seem to many. What he was trying to do was put an interesting twist on a classic Asian sauce, and while he's been doing that successfully all season long, he blew it this time, plain and simple. If that dish succeeds, Dale's still around. For that matter, a lot of things could have kept Dale around. If he had just edged Antonia in the quick fire, if he had just lost that coin toss to Lisa, if he'd just gotten Tom rather than a substitute head judge Bourdain, who probably weighed the executive chef role more in previous performance less than Tom would have. It took, as I called it last week, the absolute rock-bottom, hide-the-women-and-children, four-alarm disaster, worst-case scenario to bring Dale down. And I think that speaks to his strength in this competition. But as they say in sports, that's why they play the games. If the favorites always advanced while the scrubs always went home, there'd be no sense in having the competition at all. So we've definitely been led to believe that it'll be four chefs in Puerto Rico, which means one more gets the axe next week, and Spike or Lisa or both of them make the finals. Our guest judge, for those who don't recognize him from the preview, is Rick Tramonto, a very well-respected fellow around Chicago and, to a certain extent, the nation, whose personal flagship is True, a fine dining establishment just off the Mag Mile. Now, here's where we're going to get into some information that's on the Bravo website, but not in the televised trailer, so if you want to remain oblivious to some very minor spoilers, stop listening now. We don't see the quickfire again, but it looks like the chefs are working the line at Tramonto's Steak and Seafood, which is another of Tramonto's restaurants that I haven't yet had the opportunity to visit. It's officially described as, quote, an upscale contemporary steakhouse featuring a la carte dinner every night, showcasing specialty cut steaks, fresh seafood preparations, and an international wine list. So I'm thinking maybe the reward for winning the quickfire is the ability to choose your station for the night? As usual, this is 95% guesswork. I'm sure I have it totally wrong. But if I'm correct, this could be a really exciting challenge that I kind of like in some ways and not so much in others. It should, in theory, let the chefs who are skilled, precise, and experienced shine while exposing those who aren't, which I always like. But God help the poor sap who draws the grill station in an upscale steakhouse if he hasn't spent a lot of time on a grill station before. So if somebody gets stuck on an unfamiliar station, one of the favorites could be a victim of bad luck in the last elimination before the finals, and I don't like to see that kind of randomness this close to the big show. All things being equal, however, in a challenge like this, I'd expect Richard and Antonia to execute cleanly, Spike and Lisa to flail or flop completely, and Stephanie to go either way, depending on which Stephanie shows up. Enough with the wild speculation, though. Is it Wednesday yet?